Anansi had seen war since before the birth of this world. Even the gods in all their glory sometimes needed to fight to push back the darkness. Darkness that was sometimes from without, but at times came from within as well. From the Hyksos with their chariots to the birth of the new kingdom, he recorded it all. There was war brewing now, among the stolen people as well. Like the old wars, much of it was inside them as they fought to remain who they were. But some of it was outside as well. From the islands where voodoo summoned all the old gods and forced to expel their captors, to the smaller rebellions that usually ended with black bodies burning by the dozen. This is chapter 4 in the story of Kamau the Abaifo, and how the phenomenon now referred to as vampirism first came to the place once called the New World, then the colonies, the Americas, and eventually taking on individual names like Jamaica, Cuba, Haiti, and Barbados. Names that reflected the unique union of the original people, the stolen people, and the ones who tried to conquer them all. Welcome once again. I am History. To understand our story, I would suggest starting at chapter 1. We will all be here waiting when you return. Historians refer to the massacre at the Comb Plantation as the most violent incident involving only Europeans in the history of the island up to that point. Robert Rhodes, 1963, describes this event in his book, Obaifo, Father of the Vampire. Rhodes assembled his book from careful examination of slave narrative as well as first and second-hand interviews with family members of other people who had some connection with the men in the house on the night that Kamau visited. Rhodes writes, "Kamau the Abaifo came at night, his hands still stained with the blood of his lover Asa. Winston Beering was barricaded in the house with 7 guards, all white men, because he did not trust the black men in his employ to stand against one of their own. Not in this case, not against this man." The Comb Plantation was one of the most successful on the island, supplying 40% of his sugarcane, so Beering and his guards were well armed. They were also especially motivated because of the exchange between Kamau and Beering earlier that day. The exact words are lost to history, but Beering had been so enraged by Kamau, and the words were so remarkable, that many of the men shared the story with their families. From these accounts, we can piece together a fairly accurate version of what Kamau said to Beering. It would have gone something like this.
"You are the one who runs this repulsive display of human grossness. Good. I have traveled a long distance, and I have no interest in the activities of little men. Luckily for you, there are others back where I come from, who I hold more responsible for what happened to the Rona. But you have a woman, who I will have back. Give her to me and I will leave. If you do not, or if she is harmed in any way, then I will do things to this place that will make the wickedness you visit on your prisoners look like a mother's kindness."
I'll interrupt Rhodes' account, only to address the remarkable nature of the exchange. Kamau was an Obaifo, a powerful and almost indestructible immortal being, and so by his nature did not possess tact or humility. Beering was a white man in the time of bondage, which bestowed upon him a different kind of power. It is therefore not surprising that the clash between these two forces would have widespread consequences. Rhodes continues, "With these words, which to Kamau may have seemed measured and reasonable, and perhaps if Beering could have seen into the future, maybe if he knew the awful things that man to whom he was speaking was capable, maybe then he would have swallowed the bitter pill and let Asa free. But that did not happen. Beering was not sure which woman the arrogant black man had come for, but he could guess that it was the dark-eyed beauty he had recently purchased. There was no doubt that he did not intend to kill her, because she was young and strong and beautiful, and therefore had not been cheap. But when Asa refused to let him punish the man in the way that Beering thought would have been most effective, he cut her and left her body for any potential rescuers to find. Then he recalled all the men to the big house, armed them well, and waited. There would, however, be no great battle when Kamau came. Comb plantation slaves, who were interviewed later, said that there were maybe a dozen gunshots, a surprisingly small number given the amount of men and ammunition that were recorded to be present. Instead, what filled the night were the Obaifo's roars, reported to have woken up local residents miles away, shattering glass and violence. John Black, the freeman whose writings described the discovery of Asa's body, also wrote about what the slaves in their huts experienced. He recalls, quote,
"Noises that I did not know white men to be capable of making. Animal noises, like a mother watching her baby being sold and hauled away on a wagon. High-pitched screams like a girl being whipped until the skin in her back was nothing more than bloody wrinkled strips. These sounds and more came from the big house. And so it was that a few of us, who always had running on the mind, abandoned whatever complicated plans we had been putting together for many years and took off in the night. The sounds from the big house hiding our heavy breathing and the sounds of our old shoes slapping against the wet island grass."
It is not surprising that the activities of the Obaifo, like many other supernatural creatures, often disturbed the colonial business and resulted in runaways. When the European forces decided to send their hunters to the island, it was the disruption of the slave trade and the loss of human capital, not the destruction of property, that was listed as their primary motivation. After Kamau was finished at the comb plantation, he followed the runaway slaves into the night. He left the house burning behind him. It is available today for those who are interested in touring the site of the Comb Plantation Massacre. Kamau and the runaway slaves headed towards the mountains. Or perhaps it would be more accurate to describe it as Black did.
"We all followed, without knowing why, the monster whose eyes glowed in the night. He paid no attention to us, and the group of us, about 15 or so, stayed a safe distance behind. But for some reason, we all decided, without saying anything, that this man was our Moses."
It is here that Kamau meets the Maroons. The Maroons are the island's infamous group of runaway slaves who escaped to the mountains and formed their own community. They often had encounters with the island's colonial forces, but despite the overwhelming resource disadvantage, this community of runaways survives to this day. There is extensive account of Kamau's first meeting with the Maroons, because the individual whom he encountered was none other than the infamous queen, Nanny. This meeting was recorded by a Maroon oral historian.
"She had been scouting with a small group of warriors when they heard the noises coming from the comb plantation. Nanny knew well enough what the screams coming from the house meant, so she directed her group closer. After some time, she saw the glowing eyes of the Obaifo drawing closer, the group of runaway slaves following close behind him."
The Maroons were a fearless people, but the sight of Kamau, covered in blood with his telltale white, pupilless eyes, made them hold back. All except for Nanny, who blocked his path and looked right into the eyes of the monster.
She wanted to know why he was here, and whose blood he was covered in.
If it had been the blood of slaves, then the history of one of those beings would have been cut short. But Nanny was satisfied with Kamau's response. The Obaifo, for his part, recognized the old power that the woman carried with her. There were few like her, women who could stand before the old things and bring them to heel. From these same oral histories, we know that Nanny convinced Kamau to come with her back to Nannytown, the village of runaways that she had carved out on the side of a cliff. It is unclear how she was able to reason with the Obaifo in his enraged state, but John Black, who was among the runaway slaves that night and would become a sometime companion to Kamau, he once recorded Kamau as having said about Nanny, quote,
"She was the old kind of power that even in my long life was a rare thing. I had seen some of it in Asa, But Essa's power was steady and overwhelming. It could build like a storm. The power inside Nanny was violent and awe-inspiring, like watching a lightning strike or trying to imagine the face of a god.
We know from Black and other sources that Kamau lived at Nanny Town for a while. For months he was unreachable, kept at bay only by the will and the power of his host. Nanny was, reasonably, concerned about what it would mean if the Obaifo decided to indiscriminately wreak havoc across the island. The strategist that she was, she no doubt also recognized what it would mean for their cause to have such a weapon on their side. Most sources accept the fact that he went through a kind of madness. He barely spoke and would not feed on the animals that the Maroons offered him. There were occasions when he had to be restrained, a job that could only be done by the Queen herself. There was general concern throughout the Maroon community about his presence. Oral historians from all Maroon villages have recorded many conversations between their leaders about what to do with the monster from their homeland. But if the mountains had their own political system, then Nanny Town, with its fabled queen, was the superpower. So as long as he was under her protection, there was nothing the other tribes could do. Eventually, Kamau recovered from his madness. By then, however, word of his deeds had spread back to the English court. And while most in the court prided themselves on their logic and science, there were others who were able to make sense of the pieces of terrified information coming from the colonies. A letter from the court of King George was addressed only to Hunter. In this letter, written by one of the king's top advisors, King George speaks of a quote, "disease inherent to the Dark Continent that has made its way to the colonies." He directs Hunter to travel to the island and address the issue. While the letter from the king's advisor does not mention the Obaifo or vampirism at all, we know that shortly after the letter is dated, a character almost as infamous as Kamau himself arrives on the island. The hunter, whose real name is lost to history, was the first vampire hunter to ever arrive on the island. Ironically, in an attempt to address a single act, the king and his advisors may have set off a series of events that led to more death and destruction than they could possibly have imagined. The specifics of this decision and the arrival of the hunter on the island is in itself a remarkable piece of history.